A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about catatonia, one of those brain phenomena that's both deeply unsettling and genuinely fascinating. He's always assumed it was something seen in severe depression, a physical manifestation of that deep lethargy. But he's wondering whether it also appears in psychotic disorders. And the answer, which I think is going to surprise a lot of people, is not just yes, but that catatonia is actually a syndrome that cuts across diagnostic categories in ways most people don't realize.
It is one of the most misunderstood syndromes in all of psychiatry. Most people picture someone frozen like a statue, completely unresponsive. And that is one form. But catatonia also includes agitated states where someone is pacing relentlessly, grimacing, echoing whatever you say back to you. It is a spectrum of motor and behavioral disturbances, not just shutting down.
The glockenspiel of psychiatric symptoms. It can play any note and still be the same instrument.
That is a strange but accurate way to put it. And here is where the listener's assumption makes total historical sense. For almost a century, psychiatry classified catatonia as a subtype of schizophrenia. That was Kraepelin and Bleuler's doing. They took Karl Kallbaum's original 1874 description of catatonia as a distinct syndrome and folded it into dementia praecox, which became schizophrenia. So generations of clinicians were trained to think catatonia equals schizophrenia.
That held until when?
The DSM-5 reclassified catatonia completely. It is no longer a subtype of schizophrenia. It is now a specifier, meaning you can have major depressive disorder with catatonia, bipolar disorder with catatonia, schizophrenia with catatonia, or catatonia due to another medical condition. The shift reflects a fundamental insight. Catatonia is a syndrome, not a disease. It is a particular pattern of brain dysfunction that can be triggered by multiple underlying conditions.
The listener's question about whether it appears in psychotic disorders. The answer is yes, absolutely. But the more interesting answer is that it is actually more common in mood disorders than in schizophrenia, which is the opposite of what most people assume.
Let me give you the numbers. Catatonia occurs in about 10 to 15% of acutely ill psychiatric inpatients overall. But when you break it down by diagnosis, it is highest in mania, up to 28%. In depression, up to about 15%. In schizophrenia, 10 to 15%. So mania is where you see it most often.
That is counterintuitive. The condition most people associate with frozen stillness is actually most common in the state of maximum energy and agitation.
That paradox tells you something important about what catatonia actually is. It is not simply a deficiency of movement. It is a dysregulation of the motor system, and dysregulation can go in either direction. Too little movement or too much movement that is purposeless and uncontrolled.
Let's define what we are actually talking about clinically. What does catatonia look like when a clinician sees it?
The BUSH, Francis Catatonia Rating Scale, is the standard tool. It has 23 items, each scored from 0 to 3, and a cutoff of 2 or more items indicates catatonia. It takes about 5 minutes to administer. The classic signs include stupor, that is, reduced responsiveness, mutism, which is not speaking, and negativism, where the person resists instructions or does the opposite of what is asked. Then there is catalepsy, which is maintaining postures that are imposed by the examiner. That is the famous waxy flexibility where you move someone's arm and it stays exactly where you put it, like a wax figure.
Like posing a mannequin.
There is also posturing, where the person spontaneously assumes bizarre positions and holds them. Echolalia, which is repeating what is said to them. Echopraxia, mimicking movements. And then on the excited end, you have purposeless agitation, combativeness, and stereotypies. Repetitive, non-goal-directed movements.
The frozen statue is one presentation, but there is also the person who is pacing in circles, repeating everything you say, making strange facial expressions, and resisting any attempt to redirect them.
Those two presentations can alternate in the same person, sometimes within hours. That is what makes catatonia so clinically challenging to recognize if you are not looking for it.
What is actually going wrong in the brain?
This is where it gets fascinating. The dominant theory is the GABA hypothesis. GABA is the brain's primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. It is the brake pedal. In catatonia, there appears to be GABA, a receptor dysfunction in specific circuits, the orbitofrontal cortex, the medial prefrontal cortex, and the motor loops through the basal ganglia.
The brake system is failing, and depending on which circuit is affected and how, you get either too little motor output or too much unfiltered motor output.
That is the working model, and the evidence for it comes from the treatment response. Benzodiazepines, specifically lorazepam, are GABA, a receptor agonist. They enhance GABA signaling. And when you give lorazepam intravenously to someone in a catatonic state, a large proportion of them improve dramatically within minutes.
How large a proportion?
60 to 80% respond to lorazepam, 1 to 2 milligrams, IV or IM, within 5 to 15 minutes. This is so reliable that the lorazepam challenge has become a diagnostic tool. If the symptoms resolve with a benzodiazepine, it supports catatonia over other causes of unresponsiveness. It is one of the most dramatic things you will ever see in clinical medicine. Someone who appeared completely catatonic begins speaking and moving normally within a quarter hour.
That is almost unsettling in its own right. The idea that a small dose of a common medication can flip a switch that profound.
It tells you that the underlying circuits are not destroyed. They are in a state of functional suppression. The neurons are still there, still capable of firing, but the inhibitory-excitatory balance has gone awry. And you can temporarily restore it.
Benzodiazepines are not the only neurotransmitter system involved, are they? I have read about a glutamate connection.
So GABA does not operate in isolation. The brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter is glutamate, acting through NMDA receptors among others. There is a GABA-glutamate balance that keeps neural circuits operating in the right dynamic range. In catatonia, you get NMDA receptor hypofunction, reduced glutamate signaling, in some of the same circuits where GABA is also dysfunctional. This is the same NMDA hypofunction hypothesis that appears in schizophrenia research, which is one reason catatonia and psychosis can overlap.
You have too little inhibition from GABA and too little excitation from glutamate, both at the same time, in different parts of the circuit. The system is basically receiving contradictory signals and locking up.
That is a good way to think about it. And there is a third player, dopamine. Specifically, dopamine D2 receptor blockade in the basal ganglia and hypothalamus. This is where malignant catatonia and neuroleptic malignant syndrome connect. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome, or NMS, is a life-threatening reaction to antipsychotic medications, particularly the older ones that strongly block D2 receptors. It presents with fever, rigidity, autonomic instability, and altered consciousness.
The connection to catatonia?
NMS is essentially a drug-induced form of malignant catatonia. They share a final common pathway. Both involve D2 receptor blockade. In NMS, it is from medications. In spontaneous malignant catatonia, it is from endogenous dysfunction. And both lead to the same autonomic dysregulation. Heart rate becomes erratic, blood pressure swings, temperature spikes, muscles break down. It is a medical emergency with a significant mortality rate if untreated.
Malignant catatonia is the severe end of the spectrum, where the motor dysregulation spreads to the autonomic nervous system and things start falling apart systemically.
And this is why recognizing catatonia early matters. The benign stuporous form can progress to the malignant form. And benzodiazepines, which work beautifully for the stuporous form, become less effective once autonomic instability sets in.
Let's talk about where catatonia actually shows up in clinical practice. The listener mentioned depression. Let's start there, since that is the most common assumption.
In severe depression, particularly melancholic depression, you see psychomotor retardation, slowed movement, slowed speech, a kind of heavy physical slowing. The question is, where does psychomotor retardation end and catatonia begin? The Busch-Francis scale helps with this. If someone is simply moving slowly but can move when prompted, that is probably psychomotor retardation. If they are maintaining bizarre postures, showing waxy flexibility, or actively resisting movement, negativism, that is, catatonia.
The distinction is not just degree of slowing, but qualitative features. The presence of specific abnormal motor phenomena, not just reduced motor output.
And here is a case that illustrates it. A 45-year-old woman with bipolar eye depression is brought to the emergency department. She is mute, she is holding her arms in an odd posture, and when the examiner tries to move her arm, there is resistance followed by waxy flexibility. She has not eaten or drunk anything in 2 days. She scores 8 on the Bush, Francis scale. They give her 2 milligrams of IV lorazepam, and within 15 minutes she is sitting up, asking for water, and able to explain that she felt trapped inside her body and could not initiate movement.
That phrase, trapped inside her body, gets at something important. There is a misconception that a catatonic person is simply choosing not to respond, or is so depressed they have withdrawn into themselves psychologically. But catatonia involves altered consciousness and motor control at a neurological level. They are not ignoring you.
That is one of the most important things for families and even clinicians to understand. A person in a catatonic state is often aware of what is happening around them, but cannot generate a motor response. It is not oppositional behavior. It is not giving up. It is a neurological disruption of the link between intention and action.
Like a computer, where the processor is running, but the output ports are dead.
That is a useful analogy, and it explains why people who recover from catatonia can often describe in detail what was said and done while they appeared unresponsive.
Now, what about catatonia and psychotic disorders? This is the other half of the listener's question.
In schizophrenia, catatonia can present differently than in mood disorders. With mood disorders, catatonia tends to be acute, episodic, and highly responsive to benzodiazepines. With schizophrenia, you can see a more chronic, low-grade form, persistent catatonic features that wax and wane over years. This is sometimes called chronic catatonia or systematic catatonia.
It is harder to treat.
Benzodiazepines may produce partial improvement, but the response is often less dramatic than in acute mood disorder catatonia. Clozapine, an atypical antipsychotic, has shown particular utility for chronic catatonic features in schizophrenia. There is also ECT, which we will get to.
There is also a diagnostic challenge, I imagine. How do you distinguish catatonic negativism? Resisting instructions from the negative symptoms of schizophrenia or from oppositional behavior.
This is a real problem, especially in busy inpatient settings. Negative symptoms of schizophrenia include avolition, social withdrawal, and reduced emotional expression. Someone with negative symptoms might not respond because they lack the drive to engage. Someone with catatonic negativism might actively resist, turning away, tightening their muscles, doing the opposite of what is asked. It requires careful observation, and here is where the lorazepam challenge is so useful. Negative symptoms will not resolve with the benzodiazepine. Catatonia often will.
If you give lorazepam and the person starts talking and engaging, you are probably looking at catatonia, not negative symptoms.
And this has real treatment implications because the approach to negative symptoms, which is largely psychosocial and sometimes involves atypical antipsychotics, is completely different from the approach to catatonia.
You mentioned earlier that catatonia is more common in mania than in depression. Why would that be?
That is an excellent question, and the honest answer is that we do not fully know. But there are some clues. Mania involves a state of extreme behavioral activation, increased goal-directed activity, reduced need for sleep, racing thoughts. It is possible that the motor system in mania is already pushed to an unstable state, and in some individuals it tips over into dysregulation. The excited form of catatonia, purposeless agitation, stereotypes, grimacing, looks a lot like severe mania in some respects. The distinction can be subtle.
Mania and excited catatonia exist on a continuum, and the boundary is fuzzy.
And this is one reason catatonia is underdiagnosed in manic patients. The agitation gets attributed to the mania itself, and the catatonic features, the echolalia, the posturing, the stereotyped movements, get missed.
Now let's broaden this out. Catatonia is not just a psychiatric phenomenon. There are medical causes.
This is where the clinical stakes get very high. Because if you assume catatonia is always psychiatric and you miss a medical cause, the consequences can be catastrophic. One of the most dramatic examples is anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis.
Which is what exactly?
It is an autoimmune condition where the body produces antibodies against NMDA receptors in the brain. It often affects young women and can be triggered by an ovarian teratoma, a type of tumor. The presentation is striking: psychosis, catatonia, seizures, and autonomic instability, often developing over days to weeks. About 40% of cases present with catatonia.
I imagine these patients often end up on a psychiatric unit with the diagnosis of schizophrenia.
All the time. There was a landmark case, a 22-year-old woman who presented with acute psychosis and catatonia. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia and started on antipsychotics. She got worse, developed rigidity, fever, autonomic instability. Eventually, someone checked for anti-NMDA receptor antibodies, found them, identified an ovarian teratoma, removed it, and treated her with immunotherapy. She made a full recovery. Her psychiatric diagnosis was wrong. The underlying cause was an autoimmune disease.
That is terrifying. And it raises the question of how many people sitting on psychiatric wards with treatment-resistant schizophrenia actually have an undiagnosed autoimmune encephalitis.
The numbers are not trivial. Studies suggest that a small but significant percentage of first-episode psychosis patients have anti-neuronal antibodies. The exact figure varies, but it is enough that some centers now routinely screen for autoimmune encephalitis in first-episode psychosis with catatonic features.
What are the other medical causes?
Stroke affecting the basal ganglia or thalamus can produce catatonia. Metabolic disturbances, severe hyponatremia, which is low sodium, hepatic encephalopathy from liver failure, infections affecting the central nervous system. And here is one that catches people off guard: benzodiazepine withdrawal can cause catatonia.
That is ironic, given that benzodiazepines are the treatment.
It makes physiological sense. Chronic benzodiazepine use downregulates GABA receptors. When you withdraw the drug suddenly, you get a profound GABAergic deficit, exactly the state that produces catatonia. The treatment, paradoxically, is to restart the benzodiazepine.
The same medication that treats catatonia can cause it if you stop it too fast. The brain does not like sudden changes in its inhibitory tone.
That is the broader principle. Catatonia is a state of neurotransmitter imbalance, and anything that pushes the system far enough in the wrong direction, whether it is a mood episode, a psychotic break, an autoimmune attack, a metabolic crisis, or drug withdrawal, can trigger it.
Let's talk about catatonia in autism spectrum disorder, because I know there is a growing literature on this.
This is a particularly challenging area. People with autism often have baseline features that overlap with catatonia: repetitive movements, mutism in some cases, difficulty with motor initiation. So when catatonia develops, it can be very hard to detect against that background. The literature from the past decade suggests that catatonia in autism is underrecognized and probably more common than we think. The treatment approach is similar: benzodiazepines and ECT, but the diagnostic threshold requires careful assessment of what has changed from the person's baseline.
Because if someone has always had stereotype movements, that is not catatonia. But if they develop new posturing, new mutism, new negativism, or a marked worsening of existing motor symptoms, that should trigger a catatonia screen.
And there is a particular risk in institutional settings where staff may attribute a decline in responsiveness to behavioral issues or to the underlying autism itself, rather than recognizing it as a treatable catatonic episode.
We have covered what catatonia is, the brain mechanisms, and where it appears. Let's get to the most important part: treatment. We have mentioned benzodiazepines and ECT. Walk me through the full picture.
The treatment ladder for catatonia is one of the most satisfying in all of psychiatry because it actually works. Step 1, lorazepam. Start with 1 to 2 milligrams IV or IM. If there is a response, continue with scheduled dosing, typically 2 milligrams 3 times daily, and taper slowly once the catatonia resolves. The response rate, as I mentioned, is 60 to 80%.
If lorazepam does not work,
you increase the dose. Some patients require much higher doses, 6, 8, even 16 milligrams per day. If there is still no response, or if the catatonia is malignant with autonomic instability, you move to step 2, electroconvulsive therapy.
Which has what kind of response rate?
This is one of the most remarkable statistics in psychiatry. ECT has an 80 to 100% response rate for catatonia, often within 2 to 3 sessions. That is about as close to a sure thing as you get in medicine. For malignant catatonia, ECT is life-saving.
We know ECT works, but why does it work for catatonia specifically?
The honest answer is that we do not fully understand the mechanism. But the leading theory is that the seizure activity produced by ECT triggers a massive release of neurotransmitters, GABA, glutamate, dopamine, essentially rebooting the dysfunctional circuits. It also increases GABA receptor sensitivity and promotes neuroplasticity in the affected motor loops. Think of it as a hard reset for the motor system.
The brain's control, Alt-Delete.
That is not far off. And it is worth noting that ECT is vastly underutilized for catatonia because of stigma and because many clinicians do not think of it until they have tried weeks of medications. In malignant catatonia, that delay can be fatal.
Are there other medication options beyond benzodiazepines?
NMDA antagonists like amantadine and memantine have shown some efficacy, which fits with the glutamate hypofunction model. They are second or third line. Atypical antipsychotics can be used, but with caution, because of the risk of neuroleptic malignant syndrome. If someone has catatonia and you give them a potent D2 blocker, you can push them into malignant catatonia. Clozapine is sometimes used for chronic catatonia in schizophrenia, and it has a lower D2 affinity, which may make it safer in this context.
The treatment algorithm is lorazepam first, ECT if that fails, or if the situation is malignant, and then NMDA antagonists or carefully selected antipsychotics for refractory or chronic cases.
Treating the underlying cause, of course. If the catatonia is due to anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, you need immunotherapy and tumor removal. If it is due to a metabolic disturbance, you correct the electrolytes. If it is due to benzodiazepine withdrawal, you restart the benzodiazepine.
Which brings us back to the central point. Catatonia is not a diagnosis. It is a specifier. The question is always, catatonia due to what?
That is exactly how clinicians should think about it. And that shift from seeing catatonia as a disease to seeing it as a syndrome is what the DSM-5 change was all about.
Let's step back for a moment. You mentioned that people who recover from catatonia can often recall what happened around them. That suggests something profound about consciousness and motor control, that they are separable systems, and catatonia is a disruption of one, but not necessarily the other.
This is one of the reasons catatonia is so fascinating to neuroscientists. It provides a window into how the brain generates voluntary movement. The motor cortex and its output pathways can be intact. The muscles work, the nerves work, but the signal to initiate movement is not getting through. It is as if the decision to move and the execution of movement have been decoupled.
That decoupling happens at a specific level. Not in the muscles, not in the spinal cord, not in the primary motor cortex, but somewhere in the circuits that link intention to action. The orbital frontal cortex, the medial prefrontal cortex, the basal ganglia loops.
And this connects to a broader question in neuroscience. What is the neural basis of volition? How does a thought become an action? Catatonia is one of the few conditions where that specific link is disrupted while other aspects of consciousness remain relatively intact.
Catatonia might be a key to understanding the fundamental circuitry of voluntary movement and, by extension, the circuitry of agency and free will.
That is the provocative question that researchers are asking. The NIMH's Research Domain Criteria Framework, the RDoC, is pushing toward transdiagnostic approaches, studying brain systems that cut across traditional diagnostic categories. Catatonia is a perfect candidate for this. It does not respect the boundaries between depression and schizophrenia and mania and autoimmune disease. It is a circuit-level phenomenon that happens to manifest across multiple diagnoses.
The brain's diagnostic categories are administrative conveniences. Catatonia does not care about them.
And that is why studying catatonia could tell us something fundamental about how the motor system is organized, how it can fail, and how to fix it.
Before we wrap up, let's talk about practical takeaways. If someone is listening and they work in healthcare, education, or crisis response, what should they know?
First, learn to recognize catatonia. The Bush Francis Catatonia Rating Scale has 23 items and takes 5 minutes to administer. It should be as routine as checking vital signs in any setting where you encounter acutely ill psychiatric patients. Second, do not assume someone who is unresponsive is ignoring you or has given up. Catatonia is a neurological state, not a behavioral choice.
Third, catatonia is treatable. The lorazepam challenge and ECT are among the most effective interventions in all of psychiatry. The tragedy is not that catatonia is untreatable. It is that it goes unrecognized.
For family members, the message is, if someone with a mood disorder, psychotic disorder, or autism suddenly becomes mute, stops moving, assumes strange postures, or develops purposeless agitation, get them to an emergency department and specifically mention catatonia as a possibility. Do not assume the clinicians will think of it on their own. Catatonia is underdiagnosed because it is undertaught.
For clinicians, the diagnostic reflex should be catatonia due to what? Not just identifying the syndrome, but hunting for the cause. Psychiatric, medical, or both.
One more thing worth mentioning. Catatonia can look like someone is simply being difficult. Negativism, actively resisting instructions, can be mistaken for oppositional behavior. Grimacing can be mistaken for mocking. Mutism can be mistaken for silent treatment. These are not volitional behaviors. They are motor symptoms.
The clinical pearl being if the behavior does not make psychological sense. If the person has no reason to be oppositional, no history of that pattern, and the onset is acute. Think catatonia, not personality.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, a pigment called mummy brown became popular among European painters. It was made by grinding up actual Egyptian mummies, human and animal, imported specifically for that purpose. The pigment fell out of favor in the 19th century when artists realized what it actually was.
I have so many questions, and I want exactly none of them answered.
That is upsetting. Thank you, Hilbert.
A syndrome that spans the entire diagnostic map, from depression to mania to schizophrenia to autoimmune disease. Treatable, under-recognized, and a window into one of the deepest questions in neuroscience. How does a thought become a movement?
The fact that a small dose of a common medication can reverse it in minutes, or that a few ECT sessions can bring someone back from a state of complete motor shutdown, tells you something almost hopeful about the brain. These circuits are not broken, they are stuck, and we know how to unstick them.
The question that stays with me is whether catatonia is going to force a broader rethink of psychiatric diagnosis. If the same circuit-level dysfunction can be triggered by depression, mania, psychosis, and a tumor on your ovary, then our categories are describing surface features, not underlying mechanisms.
That is exactly the direction the field is moving. The RDoC framework, transdiagnostic research, circuit-based psychiatry, catatonia might be one of the syndromes that leads the way, a prototype for how we think about brain disorders that refuse to stay in the boxes we have drawn for them.
If you work in healthcare, education, or crisis response, learn the Bush Francis scale. It takes 5 minutes and it could save a life. And if you encounter someone who is frozen, mute, posturing, or agitated in a way that does not make psychological sense, ask the question, catatonia, due to what?
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you found this useful. It helps other people find the show.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.